From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As the fate of President Clinton is placed in the hands of the Senate, political satirist Al Franken is wondering, what if he were president? Franken has imagined it all, his campaign, the fluke election, and his forced resignation after the publication of his private journals. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Franken about his new book, Why Not Me?, the inside story of the making and unmaking of the Franken presidency. Also, we remember writer and urbanologist William White. His 1956 book, The Organization Man, was a groundbreaking work examining the rituals and routines of corporate culture. White died yesterday at the age of 81. And Ed Ward remembers the Redbird label, founded by songwriters Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Brazil took steps to devalue its currency today, raising fears that the biggest economy in South America could collapse like some of the economies in Asia. President Clinton said the administration is monitoring developments in Brazil closely, along with other leading industrial nations and the International Monetary Fund. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin said that it was important for Brazil to carry out a strong, credible economic program. Brazil's effective devaluation took place shortly after the country's central bank chief abruptly resigned. Last November, the United States and other leading nations backed a $41.5 billion rescue plan for Brazil, put together by the International Monetary Fund. U.S. warplanes have once again opened fire on Iraqi missile and radar sites in the northern part of the country. In this engagement, one of the largest yet, half a dozen U.S. planes were involved. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
U.S. warplanes opened fire on four or five different Iraqi targets. After detecting Iraqi radar signals in the northern no-fly zone, the patrol fired on missile sites and radar beacons. The pilots fired on an Iraqi long-range radar station for the second straight day, and laser-guided missiles from American F-15 fighters scored direct hits on a pair of Iraqi anti-aircraft missile sites. Iraq fired at least one missile and claims it hit something, but the U.S. says the missile missed. The repeated low-level engagements are raising some concern among Pentagon officials that Iraq might be trying to measure U.S. tactics and methods and lure U.S. planes into a trap. But Pentagon officials say the pilots constantly vary their routes and their actions, so it's harder for Iraq to predict what the U.S. will do next. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, The Pentagon.
There are new allegations of wrongdoing involving a city bidding for the Olympics. But this time, the charges don't involve Salt Lake City, as NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
This time, the city is Sydney, Australia, where Olympic Bid Committee Chief Bruce Baird says he was approached by two people offering International Olympic Committee votes for cash. One of the two, Baird says, is a member of the IOC. The IOC's Jacques Rogue says the charge will be investigated by the Special Commission probing bribery allegations involving Salt Lake City's bid for the 2002 Winter Games. Rogue also says that the IOC considered sanctions against Salt Lake Olympic organizers, but backed off after two top Salt Lake officials resigned. Australia's Bruce Baird wants IOC President Juan Antonio Samaranch to resign, since the scandal occurred on his watch, but the IOC's Rogue calls that ridiculous. I'm Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 125 points to close at 9,349. This is NPR. An Air Force refueling plane crashed and burst into flames tonight in Germany, killing four people aboard. Air Force officials say the KC-135 from Fairchild Air Force Base near Spokane, Washington, was on a mission to refuel NATO AWACS planes. German and Dutch firefighters were fighting the blaze at the crash site about 125 miles northwest of Frankfurt. 2 weeks after the launch of the single European currency, the euro, the European Union is in turmoil over alleged fraud by its executive body. The president of the European Commission is threatening to resign if a censure vote passes the European Parliament. From Paris, Sarah Chase reports.
European Commission President Jacques Santer reportedly told some euro deputies he'd quit if the European Parliament musters the two-thirds majority necessary to censure the Commission. A censure would be the first step toward firing the whole executive body. The row is over alleged corruption and misuse of funds, especially in the overseas development and research budgets. In a bitter debate before the European Parliament in Strasbourg, Santerre presented an 8-point no-tolerance plan designed to prevent fraud in the future. He urged the deputies to look ahead, not back. But critics say the scandal could severely damage the public's faith in EU governing institutions, and they accuse Santerre of downplaying the wrongdoing. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Chase in Paris.
West African military forces say they've almost regained control of Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone. The Nigerian-led troops were moving into the eastern suburbs of Freetown, where the rebels first entered the city a week ago. Witnesses told the Reuters news agency that the retreating rebels had killed many people and taken others hostage. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As President Clinton's fate is placed in the hands of the Senate, political satirist Al Franken is imagining what it would be like if he were president. He's written a new book called Why Not Me? The Inside Story of the Making and Unmaking of the Franken Presidency. His book charts his campaign, his fluke election, and his forced resignation after 144 days in office. The book includes all the documents of the Franken presidency, the press interviews, the self-made man memoir, the Bob Woodward expose, and the embarrassing private journals which were published after the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that they were not protected by executive privilege. Al Franken's previous book is the bestseller Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. Franken is an alumnus of Saturday Night Live and now stars in the newly revived TV series Late Line, a satire about a late-night TV news program. Let's start with a reading from the new book. Here's candidate Franken drawing the line between his public and private life. He's married to Franny, who he met after college.
Although a child of the 60s, Franny harbored some traditional views on the sanctity of marriage, views that I now share in principle. I admit that during the SNL years, I caused pain in my marriage, specifically the sort of pain that might have been caused if I had been repeatedly unfaithful to my wife and spent a number of holidays and anniversaries away from home in the company of a series of mistresses. When I decided to run for president, I knew there would come a time when I would have to address this issue. It's become an unfortunate fact of life that anyone running for president in this day and age must not only present a compelling vision for the future of the country, which is time-consuming enough, but also expose his private life to the closest possible scrutiny. As others have pointed out, I am not perfect. No one is perfect. Not my opponent, whoever that may be. He or she is just a man, like me. I don't think the American public wants a president who has never had any problems. They want a president who can solve problems. And my wife and I have solved our problems time and time again. With that in mind, I want to set a few ground rules for the forthcoming campaign. First of all, having already acknowledged causing pain in my marriage, I will not dignify with an answer any further questions concerning my past, present, or future sexual behavior. This ground rule should not be regarded as an admission that I am currently involved in any improper relationships. It is simply my attempt to elevate the level of discourse beyond the tawdry obsessions of tabloid journalism. The second ground rule is much like the first ground rule. It is simply that I will not confirm or deny any reports of my involvement in any improper sexual relationships. Again, nothing about this ground rule should be construed as an admission of anything. Third, I will not be drawn into a debate about what is or is not a proper sexual relationship or, like I said, whether or not I'm having one. I'm just not going to talk about that. Fourth, my facial expression while I am listening to other people discuss improper sexual relationships should not be construed one way or the other. Also, I would caution the media against employing body language experts or voice stress tests in order to determine whether or not I'm having improper sexual relations. If you do, I will sue you. The next ground rule is a little complicated, so please read it carefully. If at any point during my candidacy or my term in office, I am accused by a woman of having had improper sexual relations with her, My silence should be interpreted as a sincere belief that the woman in question is crazy or a skank or both, although it would not be appropriate for me to say so out loud. Finally, listing these ground rules in no way precludes my coming up with more ground rules later.
That's Al Franken reading from his new book, Why Not Me? The Inside Story of the Making and Unmaking of the Franken Presidency. Al Franken, do you ever wonder who in their right mind now would go into politics?
Not me. I wouldn't. Part of the reason I wrote this book was that after my last book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot, a number of people came up to me and asked me to run for public office, or suggested I do it. And I explained to them I would be a very bad office holder. Part of what this book is about is sort of proving that. Because in it, I become president, and I'm a terrible president.
And you're subject to terrible mood swings.
Yes. And ultimately, the Joint Congressional Committee to investigate the president's mood swings subpoenas my diaries, and which are very incriminating, and I must resign.
Listen, if you really were running for office, do you think Larry Flynt would be investigating your private life?
No, because I'm a Democrat. I it's a little embarrassing to have Larry Flynt sort of on your side. You know, although he has done some great things that a lot of people don't know about. Because of him, every sex shop in California has a wheelchair access ramp.
Is that just a joke or is that true?
No, that's a joke.
Just checking. just
trying,
I'm trying
to out the
just
joke.
Trying to improve my reputation as the worst audience in the world.
No, well, I'm testing the joke and you didn't get it, so it
no,
succeeded.
I just wasn't sure if it was true. It could have been true. So what do you think of Flynt's approach to unmasking hypocrisy as he describes it?
Well, you know, to me, it's sort of like, you know, an alcoholic has to hit bottom before he can start recovering. It feels a little like we're hitting bottom on this politics of personal destruction. So I think we have him to thank. if Larry Flynt is sort of dictating what's going on now, I think it might be a wake-up call that we should stop this.
All of this is forcing us to imagine all politicians having sex lives and what their sex lives are like. And gosh, I mean, even Bob Dole is doing Viagra commercials. Would you compare this to your image of politicians when you were young and the presidents were Eisenhower, JFK, LBJ, Nixon?
Well, yeah, when I was young, I couldn't imagine JFK having sex.
Well, what about LBJ, though, or Eisenhower?
Well, Ike evidently, of course, had an affair, you know, and you got to cut the guy some slack. He had a lot of responsibilities then during the war, and he was away from home, and LBJ evidently was a bit of a philanderer. So, and you know, I mean, our past presidents have not had spotless moral lives. Jefferson evidently had sex with a slave, which is an improper relationship, if you think about it, on at least two counts. You know, first of all, if you have sex with a slave, what message is that sending to the other slaves? You know, oh,
yeah.
I see. If I have sex with the master, I get to be a house slave. You know,
are there
so that, and FDR, you know, had sex with a woman, not his wife. We've heard that Eleanor Roosevelt may have had sex with a woman, not her husband.
My guess is political satirist Al Franken. He has a new book in which he imagines his own successful run for the presidency. It's called Why Not Me? The Inside Story of the Making and Unmaking of the Franken Presidency. Why did you decide to write a book that follows through the premise that you decided to run for president and actually got elected?
Well, it was an opportunity, I thought, to fantasize, one, about running for president and winning, And the other is it gave me an opportunity to basically talk about the process of running for president and, you know, and make a scathing satire of the political process, which I think I've done. And again, it was kind of addressing this idea that some people thought I'd be a fit office holder.
Did people seriously suggest that you run for office?
Yeah. Well, here's the deal. I like, they think I'm intelligent. I have some notoriety. I'm fairly, somewhat well-known. I'm obviously interested in politics. I'm used to being on camera. And I'm very good-looking. So, and I've been married for 23 years and have two beautiful children. And so yes, people have said to me, why don't you run for office? And I this is my answer. You'll see why. I would be terrible. I'm very indecisive.
What reasons does candidate Al Franken give for running?
Very few reasons. But he basically, why not me, is very operative in as an answer to that question. He in the first part of the book, I have the first little section of the book is that sort of official campaign autobiography, like Jimmy Carter wrote Why Not the Best. And I write this little book called Daring to Lead, in which explains why I should be president. But it's very unsatisfactory in terms of if you read it, you would not want me to be president. But somehow in this I win.
Now, the book jacket for this phony political autobiography, Daring to Lead, has a cover that parodies Newt Gingrich's book cover. You want to describe
right.
it?
Yeah, in Daring to Lead, in which, by the way, I explain that I am the son of the son of immigrants and the son of a daughter of a son and daughter of immigrants. So that's one of the reasons to vote for me. But anyway, in Daring to Lead... yeah, let me look at the. It's me with a golden retriever and a leather jacket and a plaid shirt and kind of work boots and on a tree stump outdoors. It's exactly like Gingrich's Lessons of... What was his book, Lessons of Leadership?
I forget what the title was, but the cover of Newt Gingrich's book seemed to be about proving that he was actually a real casual guy with a nice leather jacket.
Yeah, which is what I do in this.
Right.
I prove it.
Right. And
because there's a picture of me doing that. And that's the proof.
And even though this book doesn't really exist, it has a ghostwriter. Tony Schwartz.
Well, yeah. I that's right. Daring to Lead by Al Franken with Tony Schwartz. I just figured the candidate Al Franken would have a ghostwriter.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, Newt Gingrich is one of the people you satirized in your previous book, Rush Limbaugh mm-hmm. is a Big Fat Idiot. Did you ever expect that Newt Gingrich was going to end up resigning from being Speaker and resigning from the House?
Yeah, I was very disappointed because he's just a great guy to kick around. But, in an odd way, I think that at least he was a man of he sort of had a large vision. I mean, he had an inflated view of his own role in the world, but there were times when he was statesmanlike, when certainly in foreign policy, and I think we're going to, in an odd way, miss the man.
My guest is political satirist Al Franken. His new book about the Franken presidency is called Why Not Me? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is political satirist Al Franken. His new book, Why Not Me, imagines what it would be like if he ran for president, won, and was forced to resign. The book includes Franken's official political autobiography, Daring to Lead. the kind of campaign autobiography that you parody in your book is usually so filled with self-mythology about how the person got to the point where they are today.
Yes.
You know, all the hard work that they did and the problems that they overcame at home and in their profession and the problems their parents overcame and so on. How does the candidate, Al Franken, self-mythologize himself?
Well, the candidate, Al Franken, is sort of a combination of the real Al Franken. So he talks about his years at Saturday Night Live and discovering that people, the audiences just loved him. And talks about growing up in Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota. Candidate Franken grew up in Christ Haven,
small town. Why did you choose that name?
I just thought it'd be fun to... as part of the mythology, to be the only Jew in a small town. And so we owned Franken's department store, which had three departments, lawn furniture, men's work clothes, and driveway sealants. And my father, Herman Franken, became very bitter when the store went bankrupt and started suing the town for to take down the nativity scene at Christmas. And as a result, I was ridiculed by other kids. And once another student drew a swastika on my forehead in magic marker, and it was, looking in the mirror, I could see what that was anti-Semitism. It's plain as the swastika on my forehead. So I talk about, you know, I become the only Jewish, the first and only Jewish president. The first, because the second one is Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman's my vice president in this. And when I resign, Joe Lieberman becomes the president.
Did you read a lot of campaign autobiographies before writing your own phony one?
I read Jimmy Carter's. I read Lamar Alexander's, which was more conversations with people as he traveled the country.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. He walked. Kennedy Franken takes a lesson from Lamar Alexander. He pledges to walk the state of New Hampshire diagonally and then side to side. But it turns out to be a very slow process. So I read his, which was pretty ridiculous, and I looked at a couple others. George Bush's, the Doles had one as a couple. Sometimes candidates tend to give you a plan, their plan. That was what the Clinton one was.
There's some things that you just really capture well about how politicians often speak. And just one small example here is the way that men in politics often talk about their great relationships with their wives, and they don't realize how condescending they're actually being toward their wives in this description. So candidate Al Franken says, "The most important person in my life is Franny Franken. Not just my wife. She's not just the mother of my children. She's not just the woman who cleans my house. She's also my best friend. By that, I mean we have sex together. But after the sex, we often have a conversation."
Yeah, I always love it when candidates say, "My best friend, my wife. Come on up here, honey." You know, and my second best friend, my kid. And my third best friend, my other kid. And my fourth best friend, my father. My fifth best friend is my uncle, who has an incredible story, and I'll bring him up here and he can tell. You know, it's, yeah, it is a, I love patronizing women. It's one of my favorite things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Al Franken, and he's the author of the new book, Why Not Me? The Inside Story of the Making and Unmaking of the Franken Presidency. You had a real political advisor help you with this book, Norm Ornstein. How did he help you?
Well, in it, Norm is my my campaign manager and becomes my chief of staff. Norm is a really good friend of mine. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and he's also a Jew from Minnesota. So, but Norm and I have been friends, pretty good real good friend since 92. And he just, you know, I just pick his brain.
What kind of things do you talk with him about?
Well, the first thing I did was I assembled Norm and Mandy Grunwald and Howard Fineman. We had lunch. I took them to lunch down in Washington, and Howard came up with my campaign strategy, which my issue, which is ATM fees. That's my only issue, is eliminating ATM fees. And it works because of a break, the millennium bug, the Y2K only affects ATM machines. And since that was my only issue, I look prescient. And I've tied Vice President Gore to the banks. I've colored him as a stooge for the banks. And everything just works. And I that's why I beat Gore in the Iowa caucuses. And Gore attacks my brother, Otto Franken, who is was part of Team Franken. He is a recovering sex addict and alcoholic, but he's my brother. And when Gore attacks him, that it's all over for Gore.
Al Franken will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called Why Not Me? The Making and Unmaking of the Franken Presidency. He stars in the newly revived TV series Late Line, a satire about a late-night TV show. There are two episodes this week, tonight at 9 and tomorrow at 9:30 on NBC. I'm Terry Grossin. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Little Brown & Company, publisher of Peter Garonick's follow-up to Last Train to Memphis, Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the Franken presidency. We continue our talk with political satirist Al Franken. Also, we remember writer and urbanologist William White. He died yesterday at the age of 81. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the hit-making Red Bird record label.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with political satirist Al Franken. His new book examines the strange state of American politics by imagining what it would be like if Franken ran for president, won, and was forced to resign after 144 days. The book is called Why Not Me? The Making and Unmaking of the Franken Presidency. In the acknowledgments for your book, you thank Dick Morris for agreeing to have his picture taken for the book, even though he wasn't happy about his portrayal in the book.
Yes.
And as an example of his portrayal in the book, I thought I would ask you to read something from page 130. And this is from your campaign diary. This is an excerpt. It's called Notes from Staff Interviews. And so yeah, go ahead.
This is a point in the campaign where I'm actually have picked up some momentum. And now I'm looking for a real high-level sort of campaign consultant, media advisor. So notes from staff interviews. Ed Rollins, interesting ideas about winning support in inner cities, but very sleazy. Use ideas, but not him. No. Pat Caddell, sad face, loser mentality. No. James Carville, give that act a rest, buddy. It's tired. No. Peggy Noonan, couldn't understand what the hell she was talking about or what she was doing here. Struck me as desperate. No. David Gergen, too wishy-washy. No. Harold Ickes, he scared me. And if he scares me, then he's likely to scare others. No. Dick Morris, I like him. A can-do, go-getting, straight-shooting, hard-hitting, looking in the eye, no BS kind of guy. He told me he wasn't just going to tell me what I wanted to hear. Like that about him. Also told me I have a good chance of winning. Yes. And the last part, the Franken presidency is basically, as you know, told through the Bob Woodward book on the Franken presidency's first 100 days called The Void. And what I really like this section because The Void is... It's pure Woodward. It's and one of the things is that Woodward tends to do is rely on one over rely on one source, and in this case is obviously Dick Morris. So it's a very self-serving story for Morris.
Morris is the deep throat of the book about you.
Yeah, he's obviously the deep throat, and also the Void is full of unnecessary detail.
That's right.
Which is one of my favorite.
Do you want to give an example?
Aspects. Well, Woodward in The Void just tells you the weather all the time for no reason. But it's Woodward basically saying I've done a lot of research, but it's usually just unnecessary. He says in the introduction that he said overall more than 250 people were interviewed. Some as many as 250 times, and a few by me personally. Dialogue and quotations have been recreated based on what I think the participants probably said. When someone is said to have thought or felt something, that description comes from my research assistant, Gary, who is particularly good at that kind of thing. When someone is said to have smelt something, Gary means that they either thought they smelt it or felt they smelt it. For all intents and purposes, these concepts may be regarded as interchangeable. Weather conditions cited were obtained from my editor's neighbor's son, Paul Zervos, a 33-year-old idiot savant who can remember the weather conditions for every hour of every day of his life, even though he's unable to dress himself without assistance.
There's a lot of real people, obviously, who figure into your book. And I'm wondering if you had a lot of lawyers reading the book before it was published to prevent the possibility of lawsuits.
No. Yes. They did read the book. It was vetted by the Delacourt lawyers. But the basic, it's satire. So you can pretty much, you know, if Larry Flint can do an ad where Jerry Falwell is in an outhouse, you know, having incest with his mother, and it's protected by the Supreme Court. I think my stuff is protected. But the Delacourt people did make me put a disclaimer on the book.
Which, of course, is very funny.
Well, yeah. I mean, The part of the disclaimer that I liked the most we took out, which was just the phone number of the lawyer that made me put the disclaimer in.
Well, getting back to Larry Flynt a second, I mean, what you said is actually true, that the case that Larry Flynt took before the Supreme Court, or that took Larry Flynt before the Supreme Court, set a precedent that actually enables you to be free with your satire.
Yes. God bless Larry Flynt, the First Amendment champion.
What an ambiguous figure he is.
But as I say, you know, all those ramps at the sex shops in California, which isn't true.
I'm still laughing.
Good.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Al Franken, and his new book imagines an Al Franken presidency. It's called Why Not Me? The Inside Story of the Making and Unmaking of the Franken Presidency. Did you watch a lot of the impeachment hearings, and have you been watching the opening of the Senate trial?
I have been watching as much as I can. I was working, I've been working a lot too. But yes, I've watched a lot, and if I miss stuff, I turn on C-SPAN late at night and catch it again.
Is there any congressman or senator who you've had a change of heart about watching them?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't think so. That's a very good question. I'm trying to think. I'll go through these people. Henry Hyde, I'm a little surprised at. I think Lindsey Graham is someone who I've met and liked, and he feels like he's going a little off the deep end. I didn't really change, you know, I wasn't that impressed with Maxine Waters. She was a little harsh. I mean, it was amazingly partisan in the impeachment hearings, and I wasn't that impressed with the whole group. Although I like Barney Frank.
He has a very good sense of humor.
Yeah, I think he's a funny guy.
Do you think that, do you agree with people who say that the impeachment hearings and the subsequent trial is an extension of the culture wars of the 60s?
I've read a lot of that, and sometimes you look at these guys and you say, yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, Bob Barr in 1969 was, you know, the guy who didn't like me because I had long hair. It turns out he might have some personal problems of his own, Bob Barr. I think there's an element of that. There's an element of anger, self-righteousness, and indignation. Maybe on both sides, but I particularly feel it coming from the president's accusers. And it reminds me of some of the same feelings that it reflects the same kinds of feelings that I saw during the 60s and early 70s.
Is it easier to be a political comic during a time when politics has become the national soap opera?
I don't know. I think there's always stuff to do. I do believe that in certain ways that because this whole thing has been so salacious, that it has been in a way too easy to do comedy about it. So I'm glad I got to write a book and really take my time and really develop a story and write it really about the whole political process than having to go on late night television night after night and do the latest joke about oral sex.
The strange thing, I think, about what's happening now, I would imagine the strange thing for a political comic about the whole Clinton scandal and the impeachment is that on the one hand, it's a really serious, austere process that's underway, and on the other hand, there's so much that's just really kind of comic about it.
Really?
But anyways, the austerity is constantly there, though.
You have this incredible. You know, it's the first impeachment.
In
over 100 years, like 130 years, and it's a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
These guys decided to impeach him over this, and Henry Hyde said before the impeachment hearing started was that you can't do this on a partisan basis. This has to be bipartisan. But evidently he changed his mind. So they have taken the very incredibly serious step of impeaching the president for lying about, having sex with Monica Lewinsky, which what I'm worried about is that we're going to have these witnesses, and she's going to have to testify as to where he touched her, because part of the first article of impeachment is perjury. And he said that his testimony in the Paula Jones deposition had been true, and in the Paula Jones deposition he said that he hadn't had sex with her under the definition provided him by the Paula Jones attorneys, who said that it involved touching someone else on either, I guess, the genitals, the buttocks, or the breast with the intent to arouse or gratify. So this may come down to the president having to testify that he did touch her breast, but that it wasn't for the intent of arousing or gratifying, but that it was for balance. I mean, that's what this may come to if the House managers have it their way, and that we'll have a long drawn out with witnesses. That's what it could come down to.
Al Franken, his new book is called Why Not Me? The Making and Unmaking of the Franken Presidency. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward remembers Lieber and Stoller's record label. This is Fresh Air. If anybody remembers the Redbird record label today, it's probably because of the Shangri-Las, the quartet of twins whose teen drama set a standard for pop music kitsch. But there's more to the story, as rock historian Ed Ward tells us.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married.
It was 1963. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller were riding high as songwriters and producers, their songs up and down the pop charts. So, Jerry said many years later, after a while we got to thinking, why should we settle for 2 cents when we could have our own record company and get 21 cents? Redbird Records was born. Almost immediately, some of the brightest young talent in New York's Brill Building showed up to pitch songs and maybe get a shot at producing one. Lieber and Stoller, hot off their success with Atlantic Records, wanted to pursue a direction that would come to be known as soul. Instead, Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich wrote Chapel of Love for a New Orleans group called the Dixie Cups, and Redbird had its first million seller. Still, Jerry and Mike did have the right idea, even if the records didn't sell too well.
We've already said
Bessie Banks' Go Now is still hailed as an early soul masterpiece, even though it was the Moody Blues remake that made the charts. And then there was Alvin Robinson, who perhaps sounded a bit too much like Ray Charles for his own good.
Lord, I swear, the perfume you wear was made out of turnip greens.
time I kiss you, girl, it tastes like pork and beans. Even though you're wearing them city-fied high heels, I can tell by your giant step you've been walking through them cotton fields.
Again, the Brits were listening. This song's probably better known in its version by the Rolling Stones. One of the young wannabe producers who caught the boss's ears was George Morton, nicknamed Shadow because he had a knack for disappearing. He took two pairs of twins from Queens, an Ellie Greenwich song, and Redbird had its next number one record.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm. Gee, it must be great riding with him.
Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him?
I met him at the candy store. He turned around and smiled at me. You get the picture?
Yes, we see.
That's when I fell for
the leader of the pack. My folks were all.
Early on, Lieber and Stoller had taken on a partner, George Goldner, whose legendary doo-wop recordings had defined the New York sound in the 1950s. He knew the Brill Building, but he wasn't too sure about this other thing his partners were onto, so the label split. Redbird for the pop recordings, Blue Cat for the soul. And it was Redbird which kept having the hits. Singers are male, but the Ad-Libs' Boy from New York City is one of the classic girl group records. Even when the girls didn't come in groups, that's the kind of records they made.
I've been trying to make you love me, but everything I try just takes you further from me. You don't love me, no, no. So you treat me cruel. But no matter how you hurt me, I'll always be your fool. But if you don't want me forever, and if you don't need me forever, and if you can't love me forever, take me forever.
Like Take Me for a Little While by Evie Sands, however, came out on Blue Cat and is a fine example of an early experiment with white soul. And, of course, it only sold locally. Eventually, Lieber and Stoller had had enough. They weren't doing what they wanted. A lot of their 21 cents disappeared around George Goldner, who was addicted to gambling and involved with shady characters. And so in 1966, they sold him their share of the company for a penny, but wisely kept their share of the publishing. Times were changing, and the Brill Building pop Redbird did so well was losing its popularity. The Shangri-Las faded away, Shadow Morton went on to produce Vanilla Fudge, and an era was over.
Rock historian Ed Ward, he currently lives in Berlin. Coming up, we remember William White, author of the 1956 classic The Organization Man. This is Fresh Air. William White defined the crisis of corporate conformity in his 1956 book, The Organization Man, a study of people who had surrendered their individualism for financial security. White died yesterday at the age of 81. White had a second career as an urbanologist, serving as an urban planning consultant for many large American cities, including New York. His research included walking the streets, observing how people use them. He also observed people in the city by filming them with hidden cameras perched high above the streets. I spoke with White in 1989 after the publication of his book, City, Rediscovering the Center.
You started doing your current research during a period when planners thought it was very important to relieve the high-density population in urban areas, to relieve some of the pedestrian traffic. And what you found in your study was people actually really like crowds, or at least they gravitate to crowds.
That's right. To me, the most fascinating piece of research we ever did, I was thought it would be a very fine idea to find out when a couple of people meet on the street, old friends and whatnot, and of course, naturally, they're going to get out of the way of the pedestrian traffic stream. And my thought was that they would move right to the lee of the building. And I set up time-lapse cameras and recorded what they did over a long period of time. To my surprise, I found that they were moving not away from, but into the pedestrian traffic stream. And the longer the conversation, the more apt it was to be smack in the middle. So people talk one way, but there is this tremendous impulse to centrality.
Mm-hmm. If we follow with your finding that the best solution for a public place is to make the place attractive for everyone, what kind of public space seems to be attractive to everyone? What recommendations do you have to designers of public spaces?
Well, the first thing I do is tell a designer, spend some time at the busiest street corner in town. The greatest open space in a city is a wonderful street corner, because the most important ingredient of a successful place is a great mixture of people. This is one of the great things. One of the first things I noticed when I sort of stood out on the streets or started taking films was the, to me, surprising number of chance encounters, old friends running into each other. And I saw this happening day after day with a frequency which really floored me. And I began to realize that this was not accidental, that this really was a actuarial probability. When you get a good, tight downtown, and all the great downtowns are tight, that is, most of them have a good, tight grid pattern, the chances are that you're going to run into a lot of people that you know. That's one of the great attributes of a center city. It's much more social, you know, than people realize. Now, you ask about what other kind of spaces. I think the small urban park, this is a personal bias on my part, the small urban park is an utter delight. By that, it could be, I think of Paley Park in New York, which is all of 42 by 100 feet. Now, that's a very small space. And curiously enough, it attracts, on a nice day, you'll get about 180 to 200 people sitting, mind you. Now, that is that's a very high density. And Paley Park and Greenacre Park in New York are the two places that are most often cited for being very comfortable, very relaxing, not overcrowded, quiet, and so forth. In actual fact, they're rather noisy. They're usually crowded, as a matter of fact, of places that you go to voluntarily. They are the two most crowded places in New York. But they have a number of sort of standard ingredients which seem to me rather surefire. There's a water wall, makes a wonderful sound, sort of masks the street sounds. Most important, they are removable chairs all over the place. Not one has ever been stolen, by the way. They have a wonderful canopy of honey locust to foliage overhead. Very deceptively simple in a way. Oh, incidentally, always a nice little food counter. And they're a wonderful place to stop or to meet somebody.
You've told us some of the successful designs of public spaces. What do you think are some of the worst mistakes designers of small parks and plazas have made?
The worst mistake they can make is to shut it off from the street. Now, the most usual way of shutting it off from the street is a great big wall. We've seen quite a few of those. Or they may sink it, you know, down 10, 12 feet to get them away from the bad people. But the wall is the worst of all. And almost invariably, these places are dog places. Nobody uses them very much. Bryant Park in New York is a beautiful park with these lovely, lovely old trees and whatnot. But it was built on the idea that let's protect people from the street. So lining the street facade of the park are, one thing is elevated, about 4 feet above the street, barbed fences and shrubbery and so forth. And the thing has always been a flop. People haven't used it very much. And there's now a very heroic and, I think, extremely intelligent effort to redo the park. And the main thing that is being done, quite aside from the band concerts they're going to have and the restaurants and all these wonderful things, is they're bringing it back to the street. They're cutting down all sort of the things that make it difficult to wander in there on impulse. And all the great spaces, you sort of move from the street into the space without quite realizing that you've made any transition.
Well, you also object to how inside megastructures, which are the mixed-use places that are part hotel, part shopping, part office, part restaurant, how those and the shopping malls control behavior inside. Impromptu street performers aren't allowed in. People with handbills and pamphlets aren't allowed
in. I've just come from Cincinnati, a wonderful city. It has one of the great public squares in Fountain Square. They also have a new atrium, an indoor area, part of the Westin Hotel there. And part of the deal was that they were going to, in exchange for getting to build, you know, hire their hotel, they were going to make a big public place. Well, they didn't do it. And this is characteristic of what is happening in many cities. You see, if you're a nice middle-class person, you're well-dressed, that's all right. They don't give you a hard time. But what they really want are shoppers. They want middle-class people. And they shoo out other people. And I think that should be against the law, for one thing. But I think it's also very short-sighted. You can't have a public place and get all the benefits of having a public place and then say, well, we're only going to have those members of the public that we approve of. One of the great geniuses of a city is as a place where people come together, and that includes, unhappily, but necessarily, some people we don't particularly like.
William White, recorded in 1989. He died yesterday at the age of 81. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown and Company, publisher of Peter Goronek's follow-up to Last Train to Memphis. Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Life of Birds. We talk with renowned naturalist and filmmaker David Attenborough about his new PBS series and book. Join us for the next Fresh Air.